kids were fantastic. Every time you broadcast, it's like I'm seeing you again for the first time.
This is the Extra Hot Break Podcast episode for the week of 2022, probably. I am light rope dancer David T. Cole, and I'm here with cold open face-off Sarah D. Bunting.
We can't both do it.
And bookmobile abuser Tara Ariano.
Reading is fundamental. Welcome to Extra Hot Great for another week. We are trying to be proactive and record these pre-taped episodes well before we actually need them, which is why we don't know when this is dropping, sometime in the future after today. But we had invited our Patreon supporters to give us their suggestions for forcenings for specific co-hosts. So to tell us which episodes each one of us should watch. Sometimes they said why, not always. And we were grateful to everyone's contributions. We went through the big, big, big list of suggestions, and we have each selected one episode of television to report back on. All three of us watched all of them. We're going to start with me on Breakout Kings, Season 2, Episode 1, An Unjust...
Let the wide stick give you the edge. Speed Stick Super Dry Antiperspirant.
Breakout Kings.
No.
That's a little sweaty.
Yeah, no. Don't scan.
This one was suggested by Erica LS, who wrote to accompany the suggestion. And why not? How about an episode of Breakout Kings, the show nobody watched but me, streaming on Hulu for ...Tara? So that's how we have arrived here today. And I put it first in the rundown, since, no offense to Erica, I think we may have the least to say about it. I will admit, my heart kind of sank when the Hulu stream started with the A&E logo. I had never heard of the show before in my life, and I had kind of forgotten that A&E had an original scripted era, like a lot of basic cable channels. They went hard for scripted shows in the aughts. We may remember Bates Motel. I think that's the only one people probably remember. But there was also, like, The Glades. Longmire. Remember Longmire?
Oh, yeah. Longmire.
Ask your dad.
The original Yellowstone.
Yeah, seriously. Longmire. But also, like a lot of basic cable channels, A&E have since been like, just kidding, and gone back to filling their schedule with syndicated and reality
Yet
shows.
Yet more Axemen.
Exactly.
Now featuring Axe Ladies.
A&E officially announced that this scripted era was over in 2017, so God, close to 5 years ago. So Breakout Kings, I learned, lasted two seasons, premiered in 2011, it ended the following year. This episode aired March 4th, 2012. Were we ever so young? The premise is that three incarcerated persons with particular skills have been recruited to help a U.S. Marshals task force in apprehending escaped convicts. So right from the jump, I'm against our supposed heroes for lacking class solidarity with their fellow incarcerated people. That's rude.
The dirty quarter dozen so far. That's what it sounds like.
Yes. Based on the episode we were tasked to watch, the only one of these whose expertise was clear to me from the show was Lloyd Lowry, who's played by Jimmy Simpson, who I love. Lloyd is a former child prodigy who finished college and medical school at an extraordinarily young age. He specialized as a behaviorist, and the reason he was convicted and incarcerated is that he sold illegal prescriptions to cover gambling debts. Then there's Erica Reed, played by Sarinda Swan. She was a bounty hunter. She is locked up for having murdered the gang members who tortured and killed her dad, who was also a bounty hunter, so in reprisal for whatever gang member he hunted down. And then Malcolm Goodwin from iZombie and Reacher is Shay Daniels. He is a former gang member whose skill, based on the Wikipedia, is street smarts. And I guess it's just a coincidence he's the only one of the convicts who's not white, but yikes. So then there's non-incarcerated members of the task force as well. We have Laz Alonso from The Boys as Charlie Duchamp, Dominic Lombardozzi from The Wire as Ray Zancanelli. Ray is technically on parole when we meet him. Parole. when we meet him, he stole money from a crime scene. And then Brooke Nevin plays Julianne Sims. She was a very gifted student at the Federal Law Enforcement Training Center who got expelled for various psychological disorders that I guess Lloyd is kind of helping her with or monitoring her for or something. Seems like she would have an ADA case against the government for this ending to her academic career. But, you know, that doesn't come up in this hour. And the show was co-created by Nick Santora and Matt Olmsted, who previously worked on Prison Break. So I guess they have a lane.
Wait, why wasn't the show called Prison Broke?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's right there.
Or Shite Collar, because same concepts.
True. So this episode is about the escape of a serial killer named Damien Fauntleroy, played by Jason Bair.
Spelled wasn't Font, that, F-O-N-T,
I know.
Leroy.
Yeah, wasn't that the villain from Shrek?
That was Lord Farquaad. I'm so ashamed that I know that.
Me too. Get out.
Get out, donkey!
The name Charles Manson gets dropped to give us a sense of both Damien's manipulative powers and how prolific he was. So he gets delivered a bookmobile book with several plastic spoons in the spine, which he uses to create a shiv to take out his guard. And then he stops the dogs pursuing him by using Hebrew commands, which he taught himself in prison for precisely this mission. This was where I was like, oh, okay, this might be kind of interesting. And then the rest of it I thought was really generic. But while he was watching these scenes, I thought, oh, this is Sarah's shit.
First of all, when the prison guard hands him the book and is like, shalom, jackass.
Yeah.
I was like, okay. I will now be greeting everyone with shalom, jackass.
Mm-hmm.
And then the dogs responding to the Hebrew commands, I was like, why was this given to Tara and not to me?
Mm-hmm.
Since this is extremely my mediocre processing shit.
Mm-hmm.
But the longer the episode went on, the more the mediocre, like, eclipsed the processy. So,
yeah.
Like, I love Jimmy Simpson also, and I think I had this on my big, giant 48-page list of things to watch one day.
Wow.
It's out, because well, this is just so...
Now you know.
It's like pieces of other better stuff that wasn't even that much better.
Yeah. Damien is already known to Lloyd, who testified against him before Lloyd's own disgrace. And as the episode goes on, we see what helpful items have been left for Damien by his accomplices on the outside. Long story short, he evades capture, so I guess he's like Moriarty to Lloyd's Sherlock. But I didn't take a ton of notes because this is a procedural show with procedural beats. The shiv is cool. Lloyd's character, again... We want more for Jimmy Simpson. He has gotten mm-hmm. it since this. But he's constantly perving on Erica and Julianne, who are the only women he's exposed to, in a very first thought way that feels really antique to 2022 eyes. Like,
yeah, yeah.
He
sure.
uses the word fun bags. Like, I know this is basic cable, but my God. Like,
yeah.
He comments on Erica, like, naturally smelling like vanilla body lotion. Like, he deserves, just Jimmy Simpson deserves better than this. He did 4 seasons at Williamstown. Show some respect to Jimmy Simpson.
Yeah. Seriously.
But he also gets a scene opposite Brent Hansen, played by Nate Mooney, and the two of them played the disgusting McPoyles together on It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, so that was sort of cute. Dave, was that an oasis of interest for you in this episode?
Didn't click until you said it, because the other guy, who's a strange-looking fellow for a Hollywood actor.
Sure.
Yeah. Know,
that's a relative statement.
Character
but he didn't
actor
have his crazy
sure.
teeth and all his accoutrements in, so I didn't click for me right away. But after you said it, I'm like, well, these characters actually probably could be written in as the McPoyles in this show
mm-hmm.
without too mm-hmm. much rejiggering.
Yeah.
Partly because this show is so completely oatmeal-y in mm-hmm. everything it does. Like, if I told you there is a small, scrappy, but specialized unit in the government that does something, where do they work? And if you said a loft with an elevator that you have to, like, move the door each time you use it, you're completely right. Of
yeah.
course they do. Yeah. And that's, like, every decision about this show is the first decision that everybody does.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. What's free at Silver Cup?
Yeah.
That set? Fine.
Not even. They filmed it in Toronto and Baton Rouge. like what two
sister
locations?
Cities.
I have to think yeah. one season was in one place and the other was in the other, because nothing about this episode looked like Toronto to me at all.
And I couldn't Like the when they're like, I cannot call it Fairleigh Dickinson. I'm from close to there. We call it Fairleigh Ridiculous. Sorry, Dan Cassino. He knows. He understands, I hope. But I was like, so which one is that supposed to be? Is this the Louisiana countryside?
Right,
is
right.
this non-Jersey? It has more than one campus, but didn't look like Madison to me.
Mm-hmm. Waiting for a fax is the pretext for a meet cute between Erica and Pete Gillies, an office neighbor. I guess he becomes her love interest later in the season. I learned that on Wikipedia as well. It's a major plot point that the incarcerated Brent and Damien don't know the Marshals contract the abducted woman's runner's watch after they abduct a lady because they have been away. They don't know about this technology. Like the runner's watch. Oh boy. So
oh
cute.
Yeah.
2012
yeah,
vibes.
Fat bat. Okay.
Yeah, yeah, she's got her runner's watch and she's got her Rio 300 diamond MP3 player strapped to her arm, weighing her down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How did we feel about Jason Bear as a serial killer?
Fine. I mean, I barely watched Roswell, so I don't really have any opinion of his performance or lack thereof in that show. I know that he was sort of a blank, and that probably suits this role more so than playing Max did.
Hmm. I think I thought he was sort of well cast as Max because if you want a kind of Starman quality, he'll give you that. He might not be doing it on purpose, but in a role like this, it's sort of the Farrah Fawcett as Diane Downs principle, meaning that when you're playing a sociopath, there is a certain gap between what seems like a normal human reaction and whatever wooden thing this actor is doing.
Right.
Like Jessica Biel as Candy Montgomery, I think is availing herself of this gap. Like that sometimes a not all that talented actor can essay sociopathy or just sort of non-standard reactions really perfectly once as like a horrible killer. And so I thought Jason Bear was perfect for this, but TV writing of serial killers, oh my God, like it's always just so baroque and exhausting.
Mm-hmm.
Like, are we doing this? And this was 10 years ago and it's still going on. So,
yeah. So Charlie, the Laz Alonso guy, he was up for a big promotion. So it's a bummer that Damien fatally shoots him in this episode. But then Ray gets reinstated
to
the Marshals.
That's why it's a bummer.
Well, not for Laz Alonso's career, probably. But anyway, then Ray gets reinstated to the Marshals and vows that he and this task force will avenge Charlie's death. It's just like it feels like such generic TV shovelware. Like, no offense to Erica, I'm not mad about it, but it's like it was something where it's like, okay, I get it. I mean, this feels very of a time and of a place and of an era in TV production when like networks that didn't have a lot of ideas were just trying stuff that seemed like it had worked elsewhere. And, you know, if you get pitched by two writers who worked on Prison Break, that was a big hit. I get why this happened, but
yeah, it's just Criminal Minds, : we're allowed to say the word shit. Like, you know, and I think Erica knows.
Yeah.
She said she was the only one who watched it. And, you know, sometimes it's like that. I get it.
Yep.
Here's why you can tell it is a very generic first thought sort of pooping it out show. All the Chyrons are in the Impact font. And if you're using the Impact font on your show, one, no, don't, because don't, because that's just now the meme font. And so you can't use it.
Right.
You're not trying. And we know Impact.
Yeah. It's the Pond 5 of
sure fonts. Is.
Pond 5.
All right. Next up is my assignment, Community Season 3, Episode 17, Basic Lupine Urology. This was suggested by Mark S., quote, for Sarah, the Law and Order episode. I couldn't remember if I'd seen this before. It didn't feel like I had, or I saw it long enough ago that I didn't remember all the tiny little bitty things that that they did that I enjoyed so much. Basic Lupine Urology, of course, is referring to Wolf, Dick, Lupine Urology. It is Community's Law and Order homage, in which the gang tries to solve the case of their ruined yam project in a class taught by the late Michael K. Williams, Omar Little himself, R.A.P. We miss him. Based on this season number, I was pretty confident that this episode was not going to stray into the labored in love with itself territory that some of these episodes found themselves in on that show. Mm-hmm. And it did edge up to the border a couple of times, but it's trying to pack 43 to 47 minutes of parody material mm-hmm. into 22 minutes. So the pace keeps it from disappearing up its own ass or getting to stay there when it does.
Yeah.
The take on the credits is a bit strained. It's true. And given that every optometrist and kidney lab between my house and Rhinebeck is using it on their awnings, it was a little weird to me that Community didn't get around to using the branded font until a few minutes into the episode. But other than that, the whole episode is pretty much right on target. I'm not sure it would hold up if I watched it another time, but I really enjoyed watching it this time, and I made a list of the 12-ish reasons that Community's loving homage to Law & Order Mothership sticks the landing. First of all, the font and the Chung Chung. Second, the cold open face-off between Abed and Troy, which ends in a meta we can't both do it comment and is called back later with a unison, why do they always run bit that I enjoyed a lot.
Yep.
The rhythms of the interrogations with people bustling about slash unable to find a key piece of evidence because the office is messy. Britta, one, acting like a computer is still terrifyingly new technology that endangers children. And two, reducing a complex Boolean search string slash series of commands to three keystrokes performed as though her hands are asleep. This might have been my favorite episode moment in the whole episode. Emmy Rogers, I will not lie, I sat up straight and squeaked when I saw Leslie Hendricks, and her scene could have been lifted from Mothership mm-hmm. in its entirety, with the exception of the starch-based dialogue, of course. Dave, could you please play that clip?
He's our man, though, right?
Well, he ain't innocent. Look, I'll try to keep him busy. You guys go to the lab, see if they figured out how our yam met its masher.
I can both see and hear you.
Yam's vascular cylinder is completely disintegrated.
Any possibility it happened naturally?
Sure. The gardener's Joseph Mengele. Look at the root system. This level of smushing is consistent with someone stepping on the yam after it was dropped.
So whoever did this was angry?
Hey, I just cut him open. You want motive? Talk to a shrink. What I can tell you is that for a raw yam to get it this bad, you need more than gravity. You need a boot.
And after the word boot, Troy almost does boot, and then they're informed that the yam basically was pregnant. Special circumstances, you gotta love it. This episode also includes, hilariously, a jurisdictional dispute with the United States Armed Forces in the person of all people, Michael Ironside, aka Chester from Top Gun. Brilliant. There's heavy playing on Michael K. Williams' role as Omar on The Wire, including multiple references to a man needing to have a code. There is a late night research session with the ADAs and an absolute forest of Chinese food cartons with chopsticks sticking out of every single one, recreated here by Jeff and Annie. The quote sidebars in quote chambers with Dean Pelton, which is an excuse for the characters, not for the first or even 13th time, to note that they're not cops or lawyers and this proceeding holds no legal weight. A whiteboard crazy wall carefully filled up with so-called clues, the last minute relenting by the prosecutor, and of course, the recap slash button scene with all the law talking folks sitting around drinking brown liquor that is interrupted with a grim phone call that manages to communicate two full paragraphs of information about a crucial death that takes 3 seconds. I just really enjoyed it. It's like that. It's on the right side of that line that Community often strayed over, but this one really is this loving, felt understanding homage to the Law & Order franchises, and everyone is having a great time that they got Dick Wolf to kind of consult and sign off on all this stuff. Like, yes, the shows were network mates, but still, that's, I think, a sign of quality. And sometimes this show, you're like, I see what you're doing, but you don't believe it or you're like too proud of it. And this episode, I got the sense that like, even if they'd gotten to make it and nobody got to see it, they would have been fine with it. Mm-hmm. And that's when Community is at its best. Also, very minimal Pierce.
Yeah, he's only in one scene. You're right.
Yeah. And it's a pretty funny scene and he's wearing like a, you know, bedding visor. It's, I mean, yeah, it's good. I think this is Community at its strongest and most confident without being annoying.
I agree with that. I also have to give them credit for the way they mapped all of the Community characters onto the Law and Order characters was very thoughtfully done. And when they have, I mean, Troy and Abed obviously have to be partners. And of course, so they are the cops and they style them to look like Logan and Briscoe, like with Troy in the leather blazer. And I mean, they can't do the Jerry Auerbach thing with Troy's hair, or I mean, Abed's hair, because almost no one can do that hair, really, except it's for true. Jerry Auerbach for 50 years. The Leslie Hendricks cameo is great. The modified Miranda warning where everything they're saying is like, and once again, we're not cops. Like, you have the right to do whatever you want.
Yeah. You have the right to not tell us anything because we can't make you because we're not cops. So good.
And then when a man's got to have a code and then... Jeff is like, a woman's got to have a code too, a codette or something. So unnecessary, but so good. Boiling Water is the icicle stabbing of yam care when we get the big dramatic reveal of what happened to all the yams to sabotage them. I mean, you're so right. It was very thoughtfully done. There's a deep, deep knowledge of the source material. And Megan Ganz, we should say, is the writer of this episode and has gone on to be an executive producer on the aforementioned It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, but also on Mythic Quest. So if you liked her work here, you should check out Mythic Quest on Apple TV Plus. Also a very good show.
The only thing I think this episode was missing, and they did kill Starburns off screen, but they really needed that courtroom staircase equivalent scene that they've done about 6 or 7 times to my knowledge on this series.
Oh, more than that.
Where where the mother or the father takes things into their own hands and kills them as they come down, as the press is there and all that sort of stuff. But otherwise, it was really kind of a note perfect take, and the camera work and everything was really good. You know, they did the handheld cam when they needed to and everything. So it felt like it was like well researched, you know, and you can kind of see it. So you can see the craft, but also, like as Sarah was saying, it was funny, but it wasn't claymation Christmas look at us.
Yes.
You know,
Community. The look at us part was not there. That they weren't standing back like, see how precise this is. They just did it.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, I enjoyed it as well.
A sinister musical mastermind uses 25th century rock and roll to plot a youth rebellion which threatens the entire galaxy.
Those kids will be killed. That concert must not go on.
I'll dispatch intercepts immediately.
Just a little longer, and the galaxy is mine.
Woo! This one, for me, comes from Emily. It is Buck Rogers, Space Rockers. Guest starring Jerry Auerbach as the evil music producer that wants to infect kids' minds with mind-altering sonic waves that'll make them riot and destroy in order to destabilize the entire galaxy in a power play that will put him on top of everything. And his henchman is Bull from Night Court.
Yeah.
So it's got a lot going for it.
With hair.
Amazing. Yeah.
This episode aired in 1980. If you had told me it was 1972, I would have believed it. It does not feel like 80s vibes at all.
It's so dated.
So I'm just going to run through the episode because it is a pure delight from start to finish. Just chime in whenever you want. I can't play it under the whole thing because you will go mad, but I do want to situate you that you, when you watch this episode yourself, and I believe you will, you'll be hearing this one song about 14 times as this song.
God. It's like Gus Briggs, Zarathustra meets the Chicago Bulls, like run-on theme, like sports theme.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a lot.
But I'm not mad at it.
I'm not mad at it either.
Yeah. and anytime the band whose name is Andromeda is on, they're supposed to be this super group, like akin to, as you know, like a comparison is made in the episode to the Beatles, yet they only have this one song. And you really gotta paint the picture. So it's a trio. They have equivalent of a guitarist, they have equivalent of a drummer, and equivalent of a keyboardist. But of course, they're all playing just like
a cardboard box with string.
Yeah, like it really is a cardboard box as a guitar.
Gold paint on it.
And we have somebody tapping acrylic cylinders, like dowels, as drums. And then there's like this long smorgasbord table with sort of
like
just
a very long Simon.
Yes.
Yeah.
And he just sort of rubs his hands all over it. And of course, nobody's doing anything to the music because they're actually probably not listening to the music on set while they're doing it. And their costumes are all very sort of like, we're Christmas elves from Mars, and all of the sort of like places where like the shoulder pads are in silhouette, they have like light ropes in them, you know, that, you know, the same kind of ropes they used to put down the sides of like theater aisles so you can see where you're going and that, because that's the future.
Yeah.
Also, they have glitter in their eyebrows, which looks really cool. I was like, okay, I'll try that. But yeah, it's solid. I would say solid gold in space, but actual solid gold with solid gold in space. Like, all this needed was Andy Gibb to roll through in a satin baseball jacket, and I would have been like, wait, what are we watching?
So every time you hear or see Andromeda is exactly all of that all of the time. And they spend a lot of time watching this band play, and I don't know why they couldn't spring for a second song. But anyways, there we have it. Let's get into the episode proper.
Because their manager says it has to be, you can't do the soft stuff. It has to be this intense song that builds to a climax for his nefarious plan.
Like they've never before experienced.
Exactly.
Phrasing, Jerry.
So Jerry Orbach is Lars Mangross.
Yeah. Mangross.
Mangross. Mm-hmm. And he is some sort of music producer. Richard Mall, a.k.a. Bull from Night Court, is Yarat. Mm-hmm. And they start the episode by killing a sound engineer that's working for them and throwing him into a very, very large garbage chute system on Music World.
Yeah.
So all this happens quickly. There's a band. There is apparently this Jerry Orbach music character that is halfway to wearing Michael Jackson's Thriller jacket. And it's all a little much. And then we smash cut to New Chicago, to the New Chicago Exposition Fair, as I will call it, for a whole lot of letting you know what's going on. So, question number one, what is Andromeda?
Now, that's Andromeda, the most popular group in the galaxy today.
They have an incredible influence over young people, Buck. It's amazing.
Sounds like the Beatles.
The who?
No, not the who, the Beatles.
What's the problem with Andromeda?
Well, Andromeda is quite a phenomenon, Buck, and possibly a disturbing problem as well.
Problem what?
Captain Rogers, data has shown that within minutes of an Andromeda concert broadcast from Music World, there is a 55% surge in youth crimes.
Frankly, we're puzzled and more than a little concerned.
And what's Music World, you ask?
What is Music World?
It's an abandoned military orbital fortress. Been taken over and renovated by a conglomerate of music promoters.
And totally outside of directorate jurisdiction, I regret to say.
Oh, I regret to say. Disruptions have broken out again at the youth center. Tally-ho.
I like the idea that there's a conglomerate of music producers that have so much money they buy a orbital military base just with the cash lying around. Fantastic, fantastic. So,
but the reason Coachella. That Andromeda is on their radar is that they found the engineer's body floating in space, which to me, like, never finding a body in space is why you dump a body in space. Like, what are the odds? Where did it end up? Why did it even cross their paths, as it were?
So the kids these days, with their light ropes, are having fun dancing in their little places, whether it be New Chicago, New Toronto, New Orleans, or whatever. You know, they are basically the 25th century version of Phantom, you know, where you go to the theater to watch something that's actually happening somewhere else and you pretend you're there, but you're not, and it's weird. That's this episode. Mm-hmm. And then this happens.
Yarat, help me install this.
This thing pops out of this machine, and it's basically just a rod, and Yarat helps them install it by picking up this rod and sticking it into a hole. That's all he does, and he needed help with that.
Now, we tighten the screws.
Something like that.
Yeah, Yarat is basically like the IT guy. It's a mid-sized company who's paid to walk like 50 minutes to Darren's desk to fix the mouse that absolutely doesn't work, and it was just because it wasn't plugged in.
Yeah,
you know, that is his role here. He's got to be so pissed off. Woo, woo, woo. So he turns this thing and all the kids go crazy with the violence. It's like that detonation scene in Failsafe, but in color with disco and way more glitter on everyone's faces. And I mean, like, everyone's faces. Mm-hmm. It is a fantastic scene. Every table in the galaxy is overturned. All the oddly placed stemware is shattered. The kids steal Buck Rogers' spaceship and take it on a joyride. It's mass hysteria, mass pandemonium. Yep. And we get a little more exposition from the kids after Buck Rogers catches up with them and catches them.
All right, what exactly is going on?
I don't know. It was so strange.
We're at the Youth Center watching Andromeda, having a wonderful time when
And suddenly everybody went crazy, like someone pulled a switch.
I don't buy that. The devil made me do it was obsolete thinking even in the 20th century.
We really couldn't stop.
That's right. I could see what was happening, but it was like watching two other people doing it.
Yeah.
Music again?
Yes, that had crossed my mind.
Mine too.
This episode takes so long to let all the characters realize what is happening with the music when it was like obvious from second three what was happening. It's very frustrating that they haven't figured it out by now.
What did you want to say anything about the black uniformed fans of Andromeda who are basically like
the super
Buck
fans?
Rogers invented juggalos? Huh.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So there seems to be like if you're in the cool group long enough, you've been exposed to this long enough, you graduate to become like the equivalent of the Andromeda brown shirts, where you get a black ensemble with inflated parts of the vest. It's really weird. They're wearing pool wear and it's supposed to be intimidating.
That's totally what it is. Pool noodles.
So yeah, so there's two levels of Utes causing trouble. Regular Utes who are just now hearing this music are going crazy. Mm-hmm. And I guess like double indoctrinated Utes. And the couple that we meet that took a joyride that we just heard explain things to Buck Rogers, well, they need to be punished, obviously, and we'll hear that here.
What are you going to do with us?
You're not going to take us to the rehab center, are you?
Oh, no, worse.
What? Worse?
We're going to send you home to your parents.
Said the man dressed like a porno toreador.
Oh, we'll get there. Boy, howdy. The old dude who runs this whatever agency that Buck Rogers is working for now, he tells everybody that they found Tarsus's body. That was the mole they had working on Music World that he got flushed out into space. They found him on space. They found him out in space, which is like finding a particular grain of sand in the surf. You know, like, what are the odds? But good news, they got it. And by the way, this news is delivered by Colonel Deering, which is Aaron Gray's character, who spends the entire episode just in his control room saying things once in a while in the world's universe's Titus LeMay jumpsuit.
Oh my God. Mm-hmm. He is poured into that costume.
Yeah.
It really
she looks
is.
Fantastic.
She does.
She is like, you can hear the yeast infection, like yeasting. Poor kid.
So a plan is hatched at this point.
Doc, why don't I take a closer look at Music World? Maybe I can come up with something.
That's a possibility, Buck. Except whoever's behind this has been alerted, and you could cause a great deal of suspicion.
Not if there's a good reason for me to be there.
On Music World?
Yeah, look, Andromeda's scheduled to give their first galaxy-wide concert in 2 days.
And how's that going to help us?
It's a natural. A man from the 20th century, the time when rock and roll was born, goes to Music World and introduces Andromeda to the rest of the galaxy. It's a great promotion.
And a great cover.
That's brilliant, Buck. Absolutely brilliant.
Is it?
No.
Thank you. No.
Like, I mean, turns out it isn't, but yeah. Also, obviously, it isn't.
Yes. Like, I don't understand why Jerry Orbach even lets him get onto Music World. Like, he's clearly sabotaging something. Like, he's going to fuck up his whole plan. Why is he deferring to Buck?
Well, as Bull says, it's because the promoter said so. And oh, the promoter, the promoter velvet robe.
Okay. Well, but also it's like the cover, such as it is that the kids, as styled by the show, are such dadly squares who look like Lawrence Welk audience members that Buck will actually fit right in because everyone's like dadcore in this galaxy. So with the exception of the outfits, we'll get to it.
So that voice you heard briefly.
It's a great promotion.
And a great cover.
That's Tweaky, and in case you don't know too much about Buck Rogers, he walks around like Flavor Flav style with Dr. Theopolis around his neck. Mm-hmm. Because I don't know this for a fact, but I assume the show wanted their own version of R2-D2 and C-3PO, but only had the budget for one actor on set.
Right.
So they said, put one on top of the other. Mm-hmm. And that's Mel Blanc you're hearing there, voice of Bugs Bunny, in case you're wondering what he was up to in 1980. It was that.
Gambling debts.
Yeah. I think you're right.
Allegedly.
Back on Music World, Jerry Orbach is hamming it up as the good producer with Andromeda, who trusts him with everything in this scene that I assume is set at the Gratitude Cafe.
Cirrus, those double-looped afterbeats on Stardrift were fabulous.
I didn't think it would work. As usual, you were right.
I may have an idea once in a while. But if it weren't for this group...
Hey, if it wasn't for you, where would we be?
That's right, Mongros. You made us.
That may be a bit overstated, Rambo, but thank you. Karana, are you going to include Time Walk on the galaxy-wide broadcast?
Why?
The mood of that song is so quiet, so thoughtful. You see, on that broadcast, we want to be always building, climbing toward a climax never reached before.
Yeah. Well, listen, if you think that's best, then we'll drop it, right?
It's not what I think. It's what we all think together. Give it some thought.
I don't get it.
I really enjoyed that scene a lot. I don't know why. I think it's mostly just because it's so, like, schmoozy. He's on the cusp of conquering the galaxy, but, you know, he's also... the producer, and he's got to do this soft shoe stuff. It's kind of funny. I like that.
Well, and to give this guy who, you know, won Tony's for musical theater this absolute garbage filler dialogue about, quote, music in space, it's painful. It is painful. Orbach is a pro and does not betray this fact, but every time there's a scene like this, I just felt very bad for him.
I didn't. I thoroughly enjoyed it.
He was probably having fun. He probably did it for like his kid or his nephew or whatever, you know.
Yeah. In two hours.
Let's think about it that way.
On a Thursday afternoon.
Yeah, true. Yeah.
So Buck Rogers lands at Music World, I suppose, and is immediately attacked by the Goon Squad, which he gets out of by James T. Kirking judo chopping is also his way of fighting. He then calls on Mangros and his ditzy girlfriend Joanna, played by Judy Landers, who is not her sister Audrey Landers from Dallas. Mm-hmm. Also, she is a great actor. Really good. Excellent actor. Buck's shirt in this scene has one button maximum done up, and you can 100% see the outline and microscopic details on his dick in the galaxy's tightest, whitest pants.
They are conveying a lot of information, those pants.
None of it is for children.
No.
And then you see it from the back, and it's like all pressed ham all the time.
Well, there's, and you can also see the shirt tucked into it all weird and awkward. It's like, you know, when James Pickens Jr. wore those white chinos on 90210 at the beach club, he went commando, and there's a reason. Like, this is why.
It's something.
It's a lot.
He's a hirsute individual. He's got a lot of chest hair, as was the style at the time.
It was the style.
A lot of chest hair, a lot of porn stashes here in the 25th century. Mm-hmm. So after a music world tour by the lead of the band, he is spotted snooping around the control room where all the bad shit is happening. And Lars, that's Mangross, insists Joanna help get rid of him. And so she visits him to seduce him. But then he plays the kooky, crazy, go crazy music, which makes her go from flirty to killer. And she's got some sort of space syringe, and she tries to stab it. Doesn't work.
Yep.
Anyways, now everyone knows what everyone else's real deal is. The cards are on the table. The race is on to stop the concert from broadcasting. There is an extended scene of Tweaky reaching for a box with his useless clamp hand and walking around Music World's giant, giant garbage chutes, which, by the way, have to stink up the whole place because, there's no double doors. There's no, ceiling idea. It's just, your room has this 4-foot door that opens up, and it's big. You can obviously crawl into it. They put a body into it earlier. And the inside of it is very grimy. It's got that... Forever Alley dumpster grime look to them. So, the whole, as soon as you open the door, you're going to get a whiff of all of that. Somebody had oranges 2 days ago. I can smell
trash
a rotting
juice.
Peel.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, all that sort of stuff. And then there's the concert actually does start. More of that same damn song. More light rope dancing.
Yep.
And Lars does his evil soliloquy, as they all must do.
Youth of the galaxy, listen to me. The time has come to demand your freedom, to create your own lives. I will show you how.
During this, Buck Rogers destroys the thingamajig that makes everybody go crazy.
Andromeda will show you the way. The time is now. Go into the streets. Let nothing, let no one stop you. Destroy, so we can begin rebuilding a new galaxy. Our galaxy.
That wacko.
They called him a wacko.
Obey me.
Boy.
That scene is followed by one of the best moments in the episode as all the kids over the all across the galaxy laugh at him. There's a shot of a planet in space as the laughter becomes crystal clear and pointed.
That is the best part. You're
it's like
so
a
right.
good yeah. 2 second sort of smash cut, and it is 100% cheesy in all the right ways. 12 out of 10 would buy again. A+. It was great.
Yeah.
Also, by the way, when Buck Rogers was like, we're going to do something worse, take you back to your parents. The parents don't give a shit because those same two kids that stole his ship earlier are back for this later performance. So, they didn't even get space grounded. Bullshit.
Okay, but the exposition and setup of this episode did take 2 weeks. So it's possible they were grounded and then got off grounding and were able to go to the galactic concert.
Okay, fair.
There's also a lot of costuming choices that really make it hard to figure out when time has actually passed. Because if you told me this episode takes place over the course of 3 hours, I would have believed you. If it was a course of 2 weeks, also could have believed you. Mm-hmm. The fact that they color code everybody, even if you do change your outfit, you still have to wear green. Anyways, the band is playing again, more rope dancing, and then the episode is basically over, except for this absolutely fantastic ending.
Long live rock and roll, Buck.
All right.
Hey, Lloyd, mellow off. Oh, it's so square. And the techie talk, roll fid version. Oh, it was really delightful, actually.
It really was.
So goofy.
Mm-hmm. I recently came across a story, and it was just making sci-fi timeless versus making sci-fi that is firmly rooted in your past. There is a story that the Fox, when Star Wars was in development, they said to George Lucas, we really should have a contemporary disco-y soundtrack to this movie. And he's like, no, it should be classic. It should be like, you know, whole the planets, you know, I'll get my man Williams on it and he'll do it. But like, this is what they wanted. This sort of like crazy, not only like Andromeda, but just the music in general is sort of, you know, synthy and exactly caught between the 70s and 80s. Boy, does it date it. I mean, like everything else, obviously the fashions and, you know, just all of it. Boy, can you imagine Star Wars with that kind of music? Yeah, we wouldn't be talking about Star Wars probably.
No.
Well, and they did issue like those songs. They tried to make chart in disco versions. Like they sent it to whoever, Alan Carr, and recut it. And those were like, you know, a number 17 hit.
Well, the Miko or Mecco version, whatever it is, was number one hit. The Star Wars thing. Yeah. And maybe the Cantina one too. Crazy.
Yeah.
Anybody recognize the keyboardist?
It did look familiar.
One of them was on Seinfeld.
Mm. The keyboardist is one of Clarence's dudes from RoboCop, the gang.
Oh,
awesome. Okay.
Yeah. Anyways, thoroughly enjoyed Space Rockers. First of all, it's called Space Rockers.
Yeah.
And just like the idea that you're in the future and, you know, you've made all this progress after, you know, I mean, I think the thing about Buck Rogers, we had some sort of war in between him getting frozen and him thawing out. And Earth has learned a few lessons.
Sure.
But we still got people like trying to control kids with music. And it's very something in the water. Like around the same time, we had G.I. Joe's Cold Slither episode.
Yeah.
Within a few years of this, very thematically similar. If you don't know that, please do seek it out. We did an episode about that. Once Upon a Time is the G.I. Joe's attempt to control youth with music.
Yeah. This is also the plot of the Josie and the Pussycats movie, which is obviously 20 years after this, but still, it's an ageless idea.
It really
is. Well, and you have variations on this hypnosis plot, I guess, if you can, if it rises to that level. I don't think it does. Unlike the monkeys, the Partridge Family, like this is, I mean, and these were all written by dudes who were like 53 years old. And again, Lloyd consults book, mellow off, like, guys, don't try to do this. It's making me tired. But this was like, I mean, despite the unbelievably casual pacing of this and the fact that it was, I don't know, 12 minutes of content and then just like this single disco song to which Joe Torre used to take the field for the Yankees. It was enjoyable. I don't know. It was like, I don't know if I'd want to watch another episode, but I liked watching this one.
It's funny because watching it, I was like, Dave is going to suggest we watch this whole season, this whole series from the beginning.
And?
Hasn't happened yet, but it was, we only watched it 3 days ago, so.
Yeah, I don't remember this. I mean, I watched all of these episodes when I was a kid.
Yeah.
I don't remember this one. There is another one, it's either right before this, right after it, called The Olympiad, which is like, the Olympics in the future, what's going on?
Sure.
Which looks like this probably got some really good guest stars, I'm going to guess. But then there's one, The Space Vampire. That's the one I remember the most.
Oh, I
there's
remember
some,
that
there are some old-timers on there. So I think there's at least one or two more episodes that are worthy of a watch in the same way that Space Rockers is, you know, singular sort of stupidity to them.
Yes. Olympiad sounds like it's Buck Rogers meets Battle of the Network Stars. And like, what could be wrong about that? Nothing. That's what.
On that broadcast, we want to be always building, climbing toward a climax never reached before.